The following lecture was delivered at the 17th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Palm Desert, California, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Rabbi Yechiel Krish now presents his lecture, Reconciling Science and Torah.
The Torah has very nice things to say about science. This is in Tractate Shabbos. This is the Talmud. The Talmud says that Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmeni says in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, how do I know that it is a mitzvah for a person to study astronomy? A mitzvah, like the 613 level of mitzvahs, like the same where it says don't steal and don't murder. How do I know on that list is thou shalt know how to calculate astronomical figures? The Talmud, by the way, says, how do I know? Not, is it true? It's a given. It's a given to the Talmud that it might be one of the 613 commandments. Don't steal, don't murder, keep Shabbos, no astronomy. That's a given. And then there's a proof. A proof is from a verse. Ushmartem vasisem, ki hi chachmaschem vinaschem le'enei ha'amim. This is the wisdom and the knowledge of the nations. What is called the wisdom and knowledge of the nations? Astronomy. That's what it says in the Talmud. Calculating the path of the stars, calculating the path of the planets, and this is not just lunar calculations for the calendar. What we have here is the Talmud saying that it is a fundamental obligation for every single Jew to know how to calculate the way the stars move across the sky, which has nothing to do with our calendar. And the Talmud takes it as a given that this is a mitzvah. Now, there are like six medieval commentaries that got together to try to figure out what the 613 mitzvahs are exactly, and at least one of them, known as the Smag, came up with a list, and in the Smag's list, he lists this as one of the 613 commandments. So according to at least one major medieval commentary, anybody in this room who doesn't know how to calculate the path of the stars across the sky has done, at best, 612 commandments. You have a big tzaddik with a long white beard. He gets up to heaven after 120 years. You did great, but can you calculate the path of Mars across the sky? And if not, sorry, that's 612. Where's your 613th according to the Smag? This is a mitzvah. So the Torah has very nice things to say about astronomy. Rambam says that we used to have a Jewish book of astronomy. It was held by the tribe of Yisachar, and it was lost, so we had to borrow from Aristotle, from the other astronomers at the time. We had to borrow from secular astronomy because we lost our original book. But in fact, this was such a priority that a 1/12 of the Jewish people used to be absorbed in it, obsessed with it, to the point that they were writing textbooks. Astronomy is definitely something that Torah approves of, that Torah loves. But that's astronomy, right? Everybody loves astronomy. If you're familiar with science history, you know that almost all of science history begins and ends with astronomy. It used to be that all of the religious people, Lehavdil, the other religions, they were also very into astronomy. What about the other stuff? Well, Torah also really likes medicine. This is in Tractate Brachos. Once again, I put it in Hebrew, and I'm so sorry, but the only line you really need is those last three words, or four words. Nitno reshus l'rofei lirapos. The Torah has given permission for doctors to heal. Why permission? Permission for doctors to heal. Well, who makes disease? I mean, in a global theological sense, God does, right? What authority does a doctor have to lift something that God put into the world? God made this person sick, so I come to the doctor with a cold. Achoo! Say, doctor, heal me. And the doctor says back, sorry, God gave you the cold. Talk to him about it. I didn't do it. Go to God. The Torah nitin reshus l'rofei lirapos. The Torah overrides that rule, says you're allowed to undo God's work. You can undo God's work. God gave this guy a cold, and you have the authority to, as a doctor, undo it. And not only that, brought in Shulchan Aruch in the Code of Jewish Law, mitzvah he. It is a mitzvah for a doctor to heal the sick. So medicine, the Torah gives incredible credit to, by the way, secret. The Torah gives more credit to medicine than medicine gives to medicine. I'll give you an example. Ask any honest doctor, and by the way, most doctors are incredibly honest people, ask them if they are 100% sure that a certain cure will work or that a certain disease is fatal. Will they ever say yes? 100%. No, of course not. They will say, by the way, usually, does anybody know what they usually will say if they know their math? It's almost always 98%. We do 98% in medicine, 95% in the rest of science. So most drugs that make it to market are 98%. 98% they're going to work. That's an oversimplification of a confidence interval. Ask me about my cheating later. Okay. For those of you who get it, great. For those who don't, even better. However, when a doctor comes to us, when a doctor comes to a rabbi and says, this person is terminally ill, I'm 98% sure, we in halacha and Jewish law see this as 100% certainty that this person is sick and we can violate any Jewish law to protect them. So what this tells us is that the Torah actually views medicine even more seriously than medical science views medicine. So when it comes to the Torah's relationship with astronomy, love. medicine, love. And down here, this is a Zohar. So now this is a Kabbalah class. We should have labeled it differently. Not science and Torah, Kabbalah. So this is a Kabbalah class. This is a Zohar. And this one I was kind enough to translate. See, I got into a mood. The Zohar says that in the 6th century of the 6th millennium, the gates of wisdom shall open from above and the wellsprings of wisdom from below in preparation for the 7th millennia, which is the coming of Mashiach. Let me say it in normal words. At the year, I wrote down the year what this would be, you have to do the math a little bit, this would be in the 1700s. In the early 1700s, you should expect to see a new revelation of godly wisdom and a new revelation of worldly wisdom, and these won't just be things that will happen, predictions, these are ways of bringing Mashiach, ways of bringing the culmination of all of creation, the highest level of spirituality. In the early 1700s, we saw the wellsprings of Hasidus burst forth, a new path in understanding and studying Torah. Those were certainly the wellsprings from above. And if roughly the beginning of the modern scientific era was right around that time. We have, I wrote down some years, 1687 was Newton's Principia came out, and that's often marked as one of the beginnings of modern science. That around the time that science was first coming into its own, Hasidus was coming into its own, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe and many other people. And many other people looked at this and said, science is not just a sign that Mashiach is almost here. Science is one of the things that will bring Mashiach. So, the Torah does not have a problem with science. Not by any means. Torah, as a matter of fact, loves science. Kind of. This is from Tanya. A lot of you probably are coming here from Chabad houses. You're familiar with Tanya. That right there is a picture of the old front page of Tanya. Kind of cool to have. Historical artifact. Keep it on the screen. It's cool. What it says, though, is not necessarily something that you want to share in a room full of people who came to hear you reconcile science and Torah. And it is that the wisdom of the nations, science, defiles the mind and soul. Oops. What happened to astronomy? What about medicine? What about bringing Mashiach? It defiles the mind and the soul. Eww. Now, there's an if. It defiles the mind and soul unless you A, use it to make a living. So, nailed it. Those of us who are scientists in the room, you're safe. Or you use it to understand God better the way that Maimonides and Nachmanides, that's Rambam and Ramban, the way that they used science. But science for its own sake defiles the mind. That's harsh. What in the world does that mean? Defiles the mind. Anybody here study science and not notice their mind get defiled? Have we had that happen? I mean, if you noticed your mind get defiled, please, I could use proof for the slide. But most of us probably have studied science and the defiling of our minds is not apparent. I want to explain this very briefly, then move on. This is not a Tanya class, nor is it a Kabbalah class, but it's right now a little bit of everything, and I like it that way. Everything that we study presupposes a couple foundational ideas. Everything we study has presuppositions. Call it subliminal advertising, if you like. The Talmud never once proves the existence of God, never once says God exists. But the Talmud is studying the minutia of what God wants in this world, so there's a supposition. We assume a God, and we don't even have to say it because it's running below the surface of the entire Talmud. The Talmud doesn't prove spirituality. Instead, it jumps over the problem by subliminally giving you spirituality. I'm operating on the assumption that God is everywhere and everything, that the spiritual world is real, and therefore there is a Talmud. Science does the opposite, and it's not negative, it's just something to be aware of. Science operates under the assumption that physicality is prominent and that physicality is consistent and that spirituality is not necessarily. Not that it's not. Science isn't anti-God or anti-spirituality, but the assumptions of science, unless you're in theoretical physics, the assumptions of most science is that the table is a table, that the ständer is a ständer, the podium is a podium, that physicality is what it appears to be. Somebody who studies science is perpetually exposed to the underlying conceit that the world is the world, the physical is the physical, and it has laws that cannot be changed. That, over time, does wear away at the spiritual constitution of the mind. That is, the mind is subliminally getting from science, world is real, physical is real, and therefore, if it's not being channeled for a job or for spirituality, it can have damaging effects on someone's faith. This is mentioned in Tanya. I want to give you the whole story. I told you science that the Torah loves science. A little bit. Sometimes it doesn't. That's what it says in Tanya. What does it mean to channel the Torah, to channel science into Torah study and relationship with God like Rambam and Ramban, like Maimonides and Nachmanides? Rambam was kind enough to tell us exactly how. Now, love and fear of God are very important. They are also two mitzvahs, along with astronomy and not murdering people. Those are the examples we're using today. Astronomy, not murdering, loving and fearing God. How do you come to love and fear of God, says Rambam? By studying science. You look at the world around you. When you look at the world around you and you understand the greatness of God and the greatness of the things that he made, this is the path to attain love and fear when he contemplates his wondrous and great deeds and creations, science. And he appreciates the infinite wisdom, the incredible order to the physical world. This is a path to love and fear of God. So science, when used properly, science, when used to inspire us and to help us see God further, is, if everything, it is a spiritual pursuit. It doesn't have to be negative. It doesn't have to be positive. It is a tool, and it can be used for religion. And as a matter of fact, Rambam says it is the only way to attain love and fear of God. There's a line in Job. I don't have it on the screen, so you'll just have to trust me. From my flesh, I see God. The Hasidic masters understand this to mean that God could have designed the physical world any way he wanted. He didn't have to make carbon-based life forms. He didn't have to put my head on top. Some people would say my head's not on top. He didn't have to put my head on top, my feet on the bottom. He didn't have to line up my heart and my mind the way it is. He could have made the world however he wanted. Why did he make it this way? This way. From my flesh, I see God. He wanted me to be able to understand him and therefore left hints for what God is like in physical matter. And when somebody studies biology, chemistry, physics, anatomy, anything in the sciences, they are coming closer to understanding God because God intentionally left those clues in my body and in the physical world. He put that there on purpose. This is why, according to the Hasidic master, the Alter Rebbe, who wrote Tanya, the best prayer service will always be conducted by somebody who has a job, not somebody who learns Torah all day. Really, he says it. He says, nobody can pray as well as someone who has a job. And you know why? Somebody who has a job knows the world, cares about the world, and then actively says, I'm setting aside what I know and care about to talk to you. What is a Torah scholar setting aside to talk to God? There's no authority in them saying God's greater than a mountain if you've never seen a mountain. There's no authority in saying God is the best organizer of cells if you've never seen a nuclear pore complex. If you don't know the science, you don't really have the authority to say how great God is. The more you interact with the world, if you don't really know money, you're not a business person. If you don't really know and care about money, then you don't understand what it means that God owns all the gold and the silver in the world. There's a lack of authenticity to somebody who learns Torah and does not engage in the physical world praying in a prayer service that says God transcends, declaring that God transcends when your life it doesn't involve the things that he transcends, is a little bit deceitful. And the fact is, nobody prays as well as a scientist. Nobody can pray as well as a scientist could pray if they try this out. A lot of examples of this. Look, there's the verse from Job. I lied. It is there. You don't have to trust me. From my flesh, I see God. The Lubavitcher Rebbe loved doing this. This was a hobby of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, insofar as you could say the man had hobbies. One of his hobbies was that he would look at science and he would pull lessons out of it and say that without science, we never really understood certain things. For example, in Pirkei Avos, it says that God has an eye that sees and an ear that hears, an ayin roya, oizen shmas. And of course, we believed it. But we couldn't really internalize that until we had radio waves, until we had cameras. You understood it theoretically, but there was no such thing in the physical world, so it was a theory. Science made this practical, the idea of what it might look like to have a God who is all-seeing and all-hearing. Nuclear energy and metastasis. The Rebbe uses both, but I'm a biologist, so I'm going to lean on the metastasis one. I'm sure you'll see the mushel both ways. The way metastasis works, that is metastatic cancer, when a cancer goes from a tumor into spreading through the whole body, Rachmana Litzlan, we should all be saved from such diseases. One cell in 10,000 breaks off from the main mass. Most cells are content to stay where they are. One in 10,000 breaks off, travels in the bloodstream of the lymph, lands somewhere else, sets up shop, and makes a problem. That's evil and it's horrible. But it drives home the point that an individual can change their entire environment. That sometimes from breaking off from the influences of others and carving out your own path, you can transcend. And this is something that we might have understood in theory, but until we saw the cells do it, it was hard to ground it in practice. The other one with splitting an atom is pretty easy to understand too. You split an atom and you get an atomic bomb. You get atomic energy from splitting a very small thing. The smallest things can have the biggest impacts. We always understood lefum tzara agra, that the harder I work, the more I'll get out of what I do, that pressure helps me grow. But we didn't really see it until we understood that the thing that creates diamonds and the thing that creates oil is incredibly high pressures pushing on organic matter. When I push on my organic matter and I push it down hard, I can get a diamond out of myself, a theory that science helped us bring into practice and make understandable. I flew here on an airplane. It's why I'm exhausted, slurring my words and talking too fast. I haven't slept. And I came here on an airplane. I think most people on the airplane don't know why the airplane stayed in the sky, which I don't know why you fly if you don't understand it. People say they don't take things on faith, but if you don't know how that's up there. Fact is, I think a lot of people, I asked a friend last night, do you know why airplanes fly? And he said, yeah, the engine. I'm like, oh, well, you try it. You need wings. Don't try it. The way that a wing works is with an airfoil. That's a picture of an airfoil. All airplane wings are shaped like that. There were two theories when we first started with flight. One theory was to make things lighter than air. Had that theory won out, I would have come to you today on a hot air balloon or a hydrogen dirigible blimp, and it would have been fun. I would have had a story. But unfortunately, we decided on airplanes. They're more efficient. They're more effective. Why? A blimp, a dirigible, a hot air balloon, it says, air is in the way, I'm going to be lighter than it, I'm going to disregard it, I'm going to fight it. What does an airfoil do? An airfoil says, well, there's air coming over the curvy part of my wing, and that'll be slow, because it takes longer to go around a curve. There's air coming under my wing, and that'll be fast. Shoo! It's Bernoulli, by the way. We have our engineer, right? It's Bernoulli, but it's with air instead of water. We go underneath, that's going to be faster. Whoosh! Because of that, there's faster air under than there is above, so you get something called lift. What am I doing? Am I disregarding the air, or am I working with the air? I'm working with the air. A person has adversity all the time. We live in a world of adversity, sometimes inside, sometimes outside. The lesson here is that although it can work to transcend the adversity, what works a lot more often is finding a way to use it and spin it to your advantage, to take the forces that are pushing against you and use it for lift. If we didn't have airfoils, this would be something that we could only understand in theory. Instead, we understand it in practice. Science and Torah are special. Sometimes they don't agree. I wish I could tell you that they always agree, that science and Torah always line up. That is the Chabad house line. I'm sure it's what your rabbi told you, is that if you found a conflict in science and Torah, somebody made a mistake somewhere. The truth is we all agree. We don't. We don't all agree. You can take that back home with you. There are some things science thinks that Torah does not think, and these are actual differences. There aren't many. Most things, science and Torah do agree with each other. But there are going to be conflicts. There are a handful of them. And when we reach these conflicts, we have three choices that are conventional that you'll find in books on the subject. And each of them involve twisting something into a knot. These are very good pictures for the Inyan. I made a twisted Havdalah candle over there to symbolize the twisting of Torah. See my artistic flair. One approach is, look, the Talmudic scholars, they weren't scientists. They were working with the information they had. Their Torah's true, but their science isn't. And so we're going to take the Talmud and twist it into a bow until it looks like the Torah. And as for the Torah, which was written by God himself, he didn't really mean it. He didn't really mean it. When God says that he made the world in 6 days, it doesn't mean days. Don't be silly. God literally meant, by the way, I can't resist. God literally meant don't murder, right? But figuratively, he doesn't mean 6 days. He literally meant don't steal, but figuratively 6 days. You might notice, it's something we're going to talk about a lot in tomorrow's lecture. You might notice that people usually say the Torah is non-literal only when it makes them very uncomfortable to read it literally, and that should make you wonder whether the Torah is so non-literal or whether we just have hang-ups. It's something to think about. Anyway, one approach is, the Torah made me uncomfortable, so I shall be twisting it into a pretzel or into a Havdalah candle. The Torah didn't really mean it. I'll use my thumb, as they do in yeshiva, and I will find a way to make the Torah match what I want it to say. That's one approach. And by the way, it's not an evil approach. It's not a wrong approach, necessarily. It's all over the books. Very holy people have done it. I'm not knocking anybody. I'm telling you how it's done. I'm knocking them a little, but I'm not telling you that it's wrong. I'm telling you how it's done. Another approach is we twist science into a knot. Science and Torah contradict. Science doesn't really mean it. Science doesn't mean it. Science says 14 billion years for the universe, but it means 6,000. Twist the science. You see this done usually by non-scientists. Non-scientists say that they think really that if somebody, you know, I have a couple friends, and some of them are going to be watching this, and you know who you are. I have a couple friends in my in the community I live in right now who definitely are under the assumption that science is sort of like six guys in a basement kind of coming up with ideas, and that anybody, an armchair physicist, can outdo the work of science itself. There is such a thought process, and the answer is, I will twist science into a bow, because who says that science is binding? Science is just science. Twist it up, and now it will match my Torah. There's a third approach that you see in a lot of books, and that is, smash the whole problem with Kabbalah. Smash the whole problem with Kabbalah. You've seen this, I trust you've seen this one. You've heard that story. Smash the problem with Kabbalah. Kabbalah can fix anything, because Kabbalah's magic. Kabbalah can fix just about anything. One of the classic approaches that is not so magic and that is beautiful and that the Lubavitcher Rebbe does use on some occasions, but not on the universe debate on medicine. There is a whole section in the Talmud of medicines that are supposed to work that will not work. You are not allowed to try them. They won't work. Why the physical world doesn't seem to always match the spiritual reality. And there, an idea that's in Kabbalah, the Rebbe takes it seriously, the Vilna Gaon takes it seriously. It's in a lot of Kabbalah books. Is the idea that it used to be that spirituality and physicality were in sync with each other, and a spiritual truth reflected in a physical truth, and as time goes on and we drift from our spiritual state, they're out of sync now. So now the spiritual truths no longer cure physical diseases. This is a Kabbalistic idea. It's not wrong either. It's used in some contexts, but these are the three major approaches to handling when science and Torah truly do conflict with each other. Where I live, there's a very popular bumper sticker in New York, in blue states in general. Who is from a blue state? So you know the bumper stickers. Here's the bumper sticker. There's a bumper sticker that says, trust science. You seen that one, trust science? It's a funny bumper sticker because usually the bumper sticker that you have in your car at least agrees with the people for whom you are representing. Meaning that if you have a bumper sticker that is pro-Democrat, usually the Democrats agree. A bumper sticker pro-Republicans, usually at least the Republicans agree. No scientist agrees trust science. Not a single one. Not a single one. Ask a scientist, they will say, let me show you. I can demonstrate it. But don't believe me. Let me show. There is no theory of trust science. There's no such thing. No such concept. The reason why we don't trust science is because science is evidence. Science is not truth. Science is evidence. And by the way, I love evidence. I'm not knocking it. Don't mishear me. Evidence is the most ethical way to live your life. Footnote. Hold on. But almost the most ethical way to live your life. If I don't know something, and I'm trying to figure out how to have an ethical, healthy, productive life, the best way to do it is to collect as much evidence as possible, to look at it in a non-biased fashion, to have other people look at it through the scientific method, through one study, talking to another study, through confusion, through resolution. This is the best way to live an ethical life. The evidence-based life is the most ethical life. That is certainly the case. So science does a fantastic job at collecting evidence to help us understand what to do when we're not sure. That's what science is great at. That's not trust science. That is maybe trust the evidence-based lifestyle when you apply the scientific method properly, but it doesn't fit on a bumper sticker, so they say trust science. But the idea is that trusting evidence is a worthwhile thing to trust. However, evidence has some pretty serious limitations. The biggest one is that almost all things that we study, we do not observe directly. Direct observation is rare in science. Usually, we make an assay. Usually, we make a kind of experiment that allows us to indirectly see what we're talking about. That's a lot in molecular biology and genetics. We usually aren't looking at the cells or the particles themselves. Even when we are, even when we're operating under direct observation, we have a problem with the way that statistics works, and that is that no matter how many times I run the trial, I can never get rid of a small uncertainty. Now, that uncertainty can get very small. But I would need to run an infinite number of trials to prove anything true in science, which is why there is no such thing as scientific proof. There is mathematical proof. Math has proofs. Science has a preponderance of evidence, which is about as good, by the way, and sometimes even better. I mean, science as a preponderance of evidence is enough to tell us how to cure diseases, and they really do work. So I'm, again, not even a little bit dismissing the method, but I'm telling you, science does not claim to be a proof, does not claim to be a truth, is not a trust article. That's not what science is. This is people who are usually not scientists, but science fans. These are fans of science who are turning science into a religion that science does not accept. Science accepts itself the way that I have just described it, as the best way to figure out the truth, using a preponderance of evidence and by reducing the probability of being wrong to as close to zero as possible. That doesn't fit on a bumper sticker, but it's the truth. That's what science really is. So some people want to know, what do we do when science and Torah contradict? Is Torah a preponderance of evidence? Does Torah have an uncertainty? Any? Ask me at the Q&A. Good question. Torah, in and of itself, when it presents the world, there is no uncertainty in the Torah. When God says, I made the world in 6 days, he's not saying, I made the world in 6 days with a confidence interval of 98. God is saying that I made the world in 6 days. He's saying what is. When the Torah tells us what is, there is no more room for a scientific discussion, because a scientific discussion is trying to figure out what is. And if the Torah does the work for us, which it usually doesn't, the Torah didn't tell us how to treat cancer, the Torah didn't tell us how to develop vaccines or get to the moon. So in this regard, science is incredibly useful. But when Torah speaks up, when God speaks up and says, I'm sure because I made it, there really isn't room in the discussion for science anymore, because science is collecting evidence and I already know the answer. One of the classic examples of this, and I hate to use other people's ideas, I like to stick to Torah, but it's just such a good muscle, I can't not use it. You know the blindfolded elephant thing? I mean, it's not a blindfolded elephant. It's blindfolded people around an elephant. You can see the picture. This is an old Indian parable. It's from the Indian subcontinent. It's been used again and again and again. Let me tell you how it works. We blindfold a bunch of people, or in this case, let's blindfold just one person. And we have him walk around an elephant, and he feels the different parts, and he begins to collect evidence of what this might be. He doesn't know it's an elephant. I do know it's an elephant. He feels the trunk. He thinks it's a garden hose. He feels the tail. He thinks it's a brush. I don't know. Use your imagination. I didn't come up with pithy things each part of the elephant can be. I was a long flight. The elephant, he comes to many conclusions. And eventually, after circling many, many times, he concludes that it is an elephant. Science and Torah agree. That is, Torah, which is the direct line, knew it was an elephant. I know it's an elephant because I know the truth. And this scientist who did their evidence, did it right, came to the same conclusion, because when you take the preponderance of the evidence and keep circling the data over and over, you're likely to arrive at the truth, and we should all agree. What happens if I let this guy or gal circle the elephant for days and days and days, and they write their papers and they publish, and the consensus of the scientists is, it's a walrus. It's a walrus. There are people who would say, well, if the evidence says it's a walrus, maybe the Torah really, maybe it's really a walrus. Maybe it's really a walrus. Maybe you misunderstood when you saw an elephant, it's really a walrus. There are people who do that with science and Torah without doing it with the elephant example, obviously. But the Torah is certain about certain things. And so when science collects evidence and you come to the wrong conclusion in science, that doesn't mean that the evidence should be listened to. That means that the evidence really didn't belong here in the first place. The evidence has no room in a world where I know. The evidence has room in a world where I don't know. Another example of this that I used to give when I was a shliach on a college campus because it was spicy is the example of that very angry, very dangerous-looking grandma over there. That very dangerous-looking grandma. Let's say that I see an old lady and she needs help across the street, and she tells me that she needs help across the street because she wants to go buy groceries at the store across the street. I collect evidence. She's a nice old lady. She doesn't look like she is an armed robber. She seems very friendly, and she just needs her groceries. The evidence would tell me to walk her across the street, and the evidence-based life would be to do it, right? That's an ethical, evidence-based life. Let's say that I also knew for sure that she had a gun and was about to rob the store. And I know that for sure. Is it now, can I now make the claim that because I've collected enough evidence that it makes sense for me to follow the evidence and to walk her across the street? The evidence says she's fine. I happen to know for sure, but I have no evidence of it. I can't see her gun, I just know. It's a truth. When there is truth versus evidence, there's no discussion to be had between science and Torah. There's no discussion to be had when it's truth versus evidence. That's the point that we're trying to drive home here. Another word for this in science language is that Torah should be seen as a fundamental principle. When the evidence contradicts a fundamental principle, we don't listen to the evidence. This is something that science itself understands. And any number of repeated studies done by incredible geniuses, if they came to the conclusion that a fundamental theory had been violated, for example, a square circle, which is a fundamental theory of geometry that it's impossible. If science came to the conclusion there was a square circle, we would say the evidence is wrong, even with a preponderance of it and even with a consensus, because we do have fundamental principles. A Jew has a fundamental principle called the Torah. On the rare occasion, and it is very rare, that science and Torah truly contradict, there is only one answer, and it is, I have fundamental principles, I'm a Jew and I believe in the truth, and the evidence does not mean that I disregard the truth. Even if you've circled the elephant many times, as long as you think it's a walrus, I don't have anything to talk about. Now, in most cases, there's not actually a contradiction between science and Torah. That's the truth. It's usually not. Usually, we just have to look at the data more carefully. A lot of times, if you read the Torah right, and I don't mean you twist it into a pretzel, I don't mean you twist it into an Abdullah candle, I mean you read the Torah honestly, you'll find that a lot of contradictions are not contradictions. I'll give you a couple famous ones. One very famous contradiction that's mentioned in a lot of the older books, people used to love geometry, they hate it now. I think it's the teacher's fault. My geometry teacher was not great. People used to like geometry. Is that the Yam Shel Shlomo, which was a big swimming pool in the Beis HaMikdash. It wasn't a swimming pool. It was a big pool of water that they washed within the Beis HaMikdash, is measured as having a diameter of 10 and a circumference of 30. My engineer, is that right? Diameter of 10, circumference of 30? That's not possible. Not possible. That would have a circumference about 31.4-ish, right? Because you got to use pi. This seems to be that the Torah doesn't understand geometry. The answer is, if you look throughout the entire Torah, the Torah always subs out pi for the number 3. It's a rounding down. The Torah does not mean to say that the circumference is 30. The Torah is very, the Talmud in this case, and the Divrei Yomim, is very clear, the Tanakh, is very clearly telling us we're summarizing pi, we're estimating pi to be 3, because that's just the way we're doing our math. It's not a contradiction, it's just we don't understand the terms that we're dealing with. Rambam claims that the sun is much, much larger relative to the earth than it actually is. We know the sun to be much smaller than Rambam's measurements. However, if you count the sun's corona, you get almost the exact measurement that Rambam gets. It's just a mistake of terms. Rambam didn't mean the core area of the gaseous part of the sun. He meant to include the corona. When you include the corona, you get almost the exact same measurement. And when you include the occasional odd flare, you get the exact same measurement. You really can work with it. This doesn't have to be a fight, is my point. The Torah and science don't have to argue with each other. And a lot of times, reading it well, you won't get that conclusion. I'll give you one more. It's all over the Torah, all over Talmud, all over the commentaries, the idea of elements, the four elements that make up the entire world. Fire, water, earth, and air. Sound scientific to you or sound like a cartoon? Yeah, right, it's a cartoon. What is this Talmud? And the answer is that the Torah is never claiming that these are the elements in the periodic table of elements. As a matter of fact, Rambam does not even describe these things as having physical properties. They are ways of describing matter according to Rambam. And what those ways of describing matter might be, there's been a couple of suggestions. It could be matter, antimatter, positive and negative. It could be that it is solid, liquid, gas, and kinetic energy. These have all been brought in books, and there's no reason to believe that's not what the Torah means, because the Torah itself describes these not as literal fire, but as an influence on matter that is fire-like, which sounds like kinetic energy, and as water not being literally water, but an influence on matter that is liquid, sounds like a liquid phase. So a lot of this makes sense. We don't have to have them argue with each other. However, there is an overriding rule, which is right here on the screen, and that is the Torah is the blueprint of all of creation. Torah is the blueprint of the world, and the world cannot directly contradict Torah. It's not possible. And so science, which is the study of the building of the evidence that makes the world, science, which is the study of what the world is, will never, when done properly, contradict Torah. So when science does contradict Torah, and it's an absolute contradiction, we can be certain that the evidence is simply not correct, and we need to wait until the evidence gets better. The reason why this approach is so unique, remember I told you there are three approaches? Twist science, twist Torah, bring in Kabbalah. There's a fourth. And the fourth is, I trust science, like the bumper sticker. I trust the scientific method, and I have my fundamental principles of Torah. And on the rare occasion that I'm forced to choose, I choose Torah. This requires twisting nothing. I haven't broken science, I haven't twisted science. We have not said that science is incorrect or that science has made mistakes in its methodology. We have said that the conclusion is wrong, and so we need more work. We need more study. And that is not twisting science, that is recognizing science for what it is, a work in progress, which is what science was always supposed to be, a work in progress that we build toward. To come to the conclusion that because science contradicts Torah, Torah must be wrong, presupposes that science is totally right, and that is something that science itself would never say. So I've given you an approach that I can tell most people in the room are interested in, but I can also tell you probably don't want to bring this one back home. Try bringing this to work. I want to give you some guidelines about how to implement these ideas, about how to implement these ideas. One thing that I've met among a lot of religious scientists, Jewish religious scientists, and Lahavdil non-Jewish religious scientists, I know a lot of them. There are quite a few. More than half of scientists say they believe in God in most Pew surveys, which is, you know, pretty good for America. It's pretty much the data. So most scientists do have religion. What most of them will tell you, though, is they compartmentalize. When they go to work, they do science. When they come home, they do religion. I am here to tell you that that is not authentic to Judaism at all. There is no Judaism like that. That's not authentic Judaism. Judaism, one of the things we say twice a day, every day, the fundamental phrase of Jewish liturgy and of Jewish belief is Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. There is just one God. My God at work is my God at home. I cannot be a person who has a divided life like that. I cannot compartmentalize. It can't be that God is not true when I'm doing science and true when I'm at home. That is a form, a small form, but a form of idol worship. It's a form of believing in a duality of God. God is everywhere and everything. Compartmentalization feels good, but it is not a Jewish approach. A second thing that we never do is we try not to, in the words of whoever wrote these slides, canonize the temporary. I was in a mood. Canonize the temporary. What do I mean canonize the temporary? I want to tell you a fun story. There's a chassid of the Al Tadeva, one of the greatest chassidim of the generation, named Shmuel Munkus. Shmuel Munkus was hilarious. If you corner me later, I'll tell you Shmuel Munkus stories the whole Shabbos if you want. We can have a full-on Shmuel Munkus Fabrengen. His stuff is the best. And he's very funny with very deep messages beneath what he says. Shmuel Munkus, one time, his house caught fire and was burning down. They went to tell him, Shmuel, your house is burning down. He came, he sat on the floor, and he laughed. He laughed. And they thought this guy's finally lost it. He's finally lost it. Shmuel Munkus, silly guy, finally lost his mind. So the students came over, they got close to him, they said, listen, Shmuel, that's your house. Yeah, I know it's my house. It's hilarious. It's burning. It's burning! He was thrilled. They couldn't understand. They said, you got to explain yourself or we're going to institutionalize you. Why are you so happy that your house is burning? And Shmuel Munkus said, because when an idolater's house burns, his gods burn up with his house. My God transcends my house. I never put him in the house. He's in the house spiritually, but he's also everywhere. When my house burns, my God is fine, and I'm so happy to be a Jew. I'm so happy to be a Jew who has not taken my God and given him physical legs that can be chopped off or physical arms that can be tied together. I haven't made my God physical, and therefore my God is impervious to changing times. The Rambam, in the beginning of Mara Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed, at the very beginning, he says that for hundreds of years, they were not able to write a book that reconciled philosophy, the science of the day, and Torah. And the reason why they couldn't write such a book is because philosophy was in flux. If they wrote that book, they would say, really, Torah is saying what philosophy says, and then a new philosophical idea would come out, and Torah would be rendered wrong or stupid-looking, right? Torah would look ridiculous. So Rambam wanted to wait until the dust had settled, because it wasn't clear what philosophy really thought. We are still in the earlier stages of science. I think nobody here believes that science will not advance substantially in the next couple centuries. Of course, Mashiach will come long before that, but I think in a theoretical model, we cannot imagine that science is not in its earliest stages. To take Torah and twist it into a pretzel until it fits our science would be a grave mistake, because it would be putting God inside a house that's flammable. The science is not done, and what a lot of people have done is they have taken Torah over the ages and they've squeezed it into the science of the day only to look absolutely ridiculous. You would be shocked how many people were invested in proving that the Torah says that the Earth is at the center of the solar system in a world of geocentrism, who then had to do it again in the era of heliocentrism, who had to do it again in the era of Einstein's relativity. All you do is you make the Torah look ridiculous. Taking the Torah and binding it to science is a premature decision. The Torah does not have to fit science. Science is not done. Science is a work in progress, and science thinks so too. We cannot keep on changing Torah. We're going to have to trust that what we have is right, because although we don't trust science, we certainly do trust Torah. Authentic Judaism never gives in to nature. It doesn't do that. One of my favorite Talmudic statements, literally my favorite Talmudic statement, is Abraham looks up at the sky. He doesn't have any children yet, and he says to God, God, I know that I can't have children. I know that I'm going to be infertile forever. Me and Sarah, we can't have children. How do I know? Jupiter's in the wrong place. I don't know how he knew. Jupiter's in the wrong place. You know, sometimes people have fertility problems. Sometimes it's Jupiter. Check it out. So Jupiter's in the wrong place. God says to Abraham, fine, I'll move Jupiter. What do I care? It's God's response. I'll move Jupiter. Science is the best available evidence and usually reflects the truth of the universe, but we are not subject to the truth of the universe. Judaism is supernatural, the Torah is supernatural, every single Jew is supernatural, God is the ultimate supernatural, and we are not bound by the laws of nature as we see them. If something doesn't line up, God can move Jupiter, and something that a Jew never forgets. We believe in miracles, we do. Another way to think about science is that science describes the steady state of the world when God's not doing a miracle. Right? Science is what the world really does. The real truth of the world, when God isn't doing things miraculously. We're going to discuss tomorrow that this is one approach to reconciling the days of creation with the model of a 14 billion-year-old universe, is that God miraculously made the world faster, but that science says this is how long it would have taken if God hadn't made a miracle. Understand that we are not bound by nature. God can break the rules. He does it all the time. He split the sea. Almost everybody in this room believes God did a miracle at least once. We should be able to believe that he does it sometimes, and that might mess with the scientific evidence as we see it, because science is not studying miracles. It's studying nature in its steady state. Judaism, authentic Judaism, never lacks the courage to be different. The first section of the Shulchan Aruch is to be bold like a leopard, to be strong in the face of adversity. When people tell you this is ridiculous, you're out of your mind, that is okay. I mean, it has to be okay, right? It's going to have to be okay, at least for now, right? Because I'm giving you something that a lot of people will not see as valid. And I'm telling you that you do not have to be ashamed. A Jew is not ashamed. And as a matter of fact, when you are not ashamed, the world is not ashamed. The world does not come after people who are confident in themselves and their beliefs. The world comes after shaky people. I'll give you a quick story, and with that, we're going to have to conclude. I told you I'm a writer now. I've been doing writing, science writing for a long time. I have a long portfolio. And my portfolio has, of my favorite articles, has like, you know, 300 of my favorites, because I have no self-control. So like 300 of my favorite articles, but I'm not dumb about it. I apply to science jobs, I know my audience, and I've written on this topic before. I've written on this topic quite a bit. If you took the JLI science class, I was involved in some of the parts of it. So I've written on this and it has my name on it. So I have that in my portfolio, but when I'm applying to a science job, I take that and put it at number 300 in the portfolio, you understand? I don't need this front and center. I don't get rid of it, but it certainly does need to be front and center. We were hiring somebody at Rockefeller, where I work. We were hiring a new writer the other day, about a couple weeks ago. We were hiring a new writer, and my boss asked me, what do you think we should look for in hiring a new writer? I gave her some ideas. And she said, I want to let you know what I looked at when I hired you. I'd love to know. She said, you know how writers always put the work they don't want you to see at the bottom of their portfolio? So it's either the one about intermarriage or the age of the universe. Either way, I'm in trouble. So she scrolls down and she reads my Age of the Universe article, where, spoiler, I firmly defend the position that the world is only about 6,000 years old. And I defend it, I think, pretty well. And she read that article, and she said, I read that one. And I said, why'd you hire me? Hired somebody who thinks that I hired like a young earth creationist. I'm not, but you know, like that. She said that I was looking for somebody defending something that I felt was indefensible, and I liked the way you did it. I liked the writing. I don't agree with you, but I'm looking for somebody who can write that way, who can write well enough and can speak well enough that they can defend their principles to me in a coherent, logical way, even if I don't agree. She's not an exception to the rule. A lot of the world will feel this way if you state your principles clearly and you're honest and you're open and you're not a jerk. Very frequently, the entire world is ready to join you in your mission. The last thing I want to say, and with that we're going to conclude, is that the number one value of a Jew is that we do not put theory before practice. No matter how confused we might be about science and religion or about any of the things that get in the way of our practice of Torah and mitzvahs, that all is put to the side by a Jew. A Jew says, Nasa v'nishma, I will do and later on I will understand. You need to find, if you're involved in science, you must find a way to reconcile science and Torah enough that it doesn't get in the way of your performance of Torah and mitzvahs. I have given you one model, but please take a different one if it helps you do mitzvahs and learn Torah. The theory does not matter at all compared to the practice. The most important thing is that science should never be a barrier to somebody taking on a deeper commitment to Torah and mitzvahs. The question that was asked, in case you didn't hear, is that I said the Torah is sure about things. And I don't know your name. What was your name? Yosef. Yosef pointed out brilliantly that the Torah does not seem sure about a lot of things. A lot of things are up for debate in the Torah. I have two answers, and I want to think about three or four more. So I'm going to give you two right now, and I'd love to corner you later so we can talk through some of the other ones, because I think it's a really smart question. One answer is that on the fundamental principles, Torah does not have debates. Not really. When it comes down to what is and what isn't, you don't see a lot of machlokas, you don't see a lot of debate in the Talmud over mitzias, over what is. You see a lot of debate in the Talmud over what could be. I'll tell you why I can make this claim. A bas kol. A voice from heaven. So sometimes a voice from heaven appears in the Talmud and announces the bottom line of a law. We don't listen to it. We say, no Torah's on earth. However, there's an exception. Sometimes we do listen to the bas kol in the Talmud. Do you know when we listen? The commentaries say exactly when we listen. Oh, you know? So I'll tell you the klal, and then you can apply it to the prat. Here's the general rule. A bas kol is not allowed to tell us how to decide Jewish law, but a bas kol, a voice from heaven, is allowed to tell us what is, and then we trust it. So if we're asking, is this a thing? Is this here? Is this there? Or is somebody alive? Is somebody dead? We do trust a voice from heaven. We don't trust a voice from heaven to tell us what to do with that information. That's for people. We decide what to do with metzias, with existence, but the existence itself is not up for debate. So all the Talmud's debates are over what to do with an extant piece of matter. Whether the matter is there or not isn't usually debated in the Talmud. That's my first answer. My second answer is the classic Elu ve'elu divrei likim chayim, that in the Talmud, all of the opinions are the words of the one true God. So although they appear to be arguments, they are in fact one statement of fact. We don't actually have divergent views in the Talmud. We simply have divergent takes off of the same one infinite God. I want to think of more answers, but those are two provisional ones. Let's talk more outside.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.